Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Focus Group Podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark. And this week, we're going to talk about a U.S. Senate race that many of you have written in asking me what I think about it. That Senate race is in Maryland. And to be honest, I am somewhat conflicted about it. Republicans are going to nominate Larry Hogan, a popular two-term governor who's been a consistent Trump critic. He's the only Republican to make this race even remotely competitive. Now, I am a bit of a Larry Hogan fangirl, and I even tried to recruit him to run against Trump in 2020. But as much as I hope a Senator Hogan would be a Mitt Romney-style Trump critic, he'd be a step toward a bigger Republican majority, and I'm loath to give this MAGA version of the Republican Party any more power, especially when we are staring down the barrel of a second Trump administration. This race will be decided by Democratic-leaning voters in Maryland who once crossed over and voted for Hogan as governor. Today, we're going to hear how they're thinking about Hogan's Senate bid and his Democratic challengers. My guest today is Michael Steele, former lieutenant governor of Maryland and chairman of the Republican National Committee and current host of the Michael Steele podcast, as well as The Weekend on MSNBC, which airs on The Weekend. He was also a Republican nominee for this very U.S. Senate seat in 2006. Michael, my friend, thanks for being here.
Hey, Sarah, it's so good to be a part of this conversation with you. I love your focus group work, and to have it targeted on Maryland is a special treat.
Yeah, now I'm glad. I'm glad we got this OG Marylander. We're going to send you this focus group mug for being on the show.
There we go.
I don't know if you know that. You get swag from this show. So what did you learn in your days as lieutenant governor and as a Senate candidate that are important for our listeners to know just about Maryland and its political culture generally?
This is a very good question. One of the things I learned very early on in my emerging career in Maryland politics was there's a very big difference between the elected leadership of the political parties, particularly on the left with Democrats, from the rank and file voter out there, everyday citizens. Maryland is much more of a center-left, center-right state, depending on the issue. It is not as progressive as the legislators in the state legislature. It is not as conservative as you hear hard-right Republicans claim. It is nowhere near that level of conservatism. We're in the South, but we ain't deep South. So the reality of Maryland has always been, from my days as a county chairman for 6 years, state vice chairman for 2 years, and state chairman for 2 years, has looked at Maryland through a very different lens. In fact, the strategy that I crafted to win the governorship in 2010 was accelerated and allowing us to win in 2002. Because the ability to understand exactly how the electorate was moving and responding to a Republican candidate like Bob Ehrlich. And I was the conservative on that ticket. Bob Ehrlich was a centrist Republican out of the old school cloth. Same with Larry Hogan. And what Larry Hogan wound up proving was the point that Maryland is much more centrist in its expectation of governance by the chief executive than the political leadership of both parties would allow for. And I give you the contrast between the 8 years of Larry Hogan and his predecessor, Democratic Governor Martin O'Malley, in terms of his leadership styles was very much out of line, you know, with raising taxes versus not raising taxes. So there's some real contrast there.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I moved to Maryland not that long ago. I was really surprised listening to this focus group. We did two groups of Maryland voters. And granted, there are people who voted for Hogan and then voted for Biden. But the number of people who talked about wanting moderate politics and liking Larry Hogan's moderation was, oh, it's just music to my like little centrist heart over here. I was like, these are all my people, really filled with thoughtful people and, you know, not hugely partisan. Now, I'm sure if we'd screened differently, we would have gotten some different people, but these groups were really great. All right. So we conducted these two groups. They voted for Hogan for governor in 2018 when he ran for his second term. And then they voted for Biden in 2020. And they basically were Democrats. Like they were voting in Democratic primaries. So let's listen to what they liked about Governor Hogan.
I voted for Hogan because I live in Baltimore City, and of so many things that was happening in the city, to me, it felt like he was not afraid to stand up and say what needed to be said and call for change, even though it wasn't ideal. And he maybe upset a lot of people. What needed to happen to make sure that our city was safe, I think he had no problem stepping up.
Even though he was Republican, he just felt like a Democratic person to me for some reason.
I liked his leadership style whenever I would see him speak. I kind of believed what he was saying. And I saw a lot of action come from him. He was just a likable person. And I do remember a lot of others in the Republican Party did not like him. But I felt like, okay, yes, he was conservative, but like he found that middle ground.
I think one of the first things he did was like lower tolls going over the Bay Bridge, which that's always nice. Not like it is a super hit to my pocketbook, so I don't go that often, but it was just a nice little thing. And then like he was pretty friendly on the refugees, which was a contrast to a lot of the GOP. He pushed back on some of Trump's like COVID issues.
It's more conservative in a lot of ways, but then still not extreme as the far right are saying right now or has been spewing throughout, right? And I feel like he's the Republican that was back in the day Republican, right? They have some standards, they have morals, and they're not just spewing things all over the place just to get heard.
A lot of what would draw me to Hogan is how he behaved on January 6th. That of all the people that were reached out to provide additional police support for the Capitol Police, he eventually was the one who sent state troopers in and may have saved our democracy in doing that. And that just shows tremendous political courage, in my opinion.
Yeah, I remember COVID, where you couldn't find a mask. And so he went international, got a bunch of masks, brought them back to Maryland for Marylanders. And I think he handled that very well.
He was undergoing very brutal cancer treatment, and he did not resign. He continued doing his work. That says something about the character. The second thing that I liked about Hogan was this support for charter schools, because I think parents should have a choice in where to send their children. I fully embraced this idea, and he embraced it too.
So I got to tell you, there are politicians all over the country who would kill to have listened to these focus groups and listened to a bunch of people remember specific things that you did. And the way to, I mean, one of the things that's notable to me is how much women liked him, how much Black voters liked him. And I know this about Larry Hogan. He loves his polling that shows, you know, he's like the second most popular governor in the country when he was governor. But he was very popular with groups for whom Republicans are not typically popular. And he was very proud of that. So I wonder, what do you think it is about Hogan that allowed him to cultivate such a good relationship with the voters of Maryland, including across the aisle? Why do they like him so much?
Well, I think there are a number of things that you hear in this initial part of the focus group, starting with one of the last things that you heard. His administration began with a horrific cancer diagnosis, which stunned not just the political class in the state, but stunned a lot of Marylanders who had taken a leap of faith moving off of Martin O'Malley, who was his predecessor that I referred to before, and all that that represented, sort of moving away from their fallback on Democrats after the Ehrlich Steele administration. And I think they people saw leadership that was so personal, the sacrifice of leadership that was so personal. Here you get this, you know, very damning cancer notification. And the expectation at the time was, well, he's going to resign. And there was already preparation for his Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford to assume responsibilities for governing that would lead to a transition to a Rutherford administration. And Larry showed sort of a stick-to-itiveness that Marylanders define themselves by. I mean, we are hardworking blue-collar people. We're watermen and farmers and manufacturers, you know, teachers and firemen and police officers, you know, people who are all about service. And that sort of stick-to-itiveness resonated with a lot of Marylanders. And it was almost an unspoken expectation that they had. And it was a test to see whether or not he would meet that expectation, and he did. So that began to cement them in a very important place, their heart, and how they looked at him. The second thing goes then to the what he did. COVID hits, certainly Freddie Gray's murder in Baltimore City. Then you have a number of other things that matter to folks in the educational space, the economy space, that Larry stood up to. I appreciate the comment at the end there about his support of charter schools, since I was the author and champion of charter schools during our administration. Okay, we'll give credit to the next Republican governor for that as well. But that sort of through line on policy initiatives that weren't scary, that were mainstream, and that had a patina of Republican ideology and philosophy attached to them, didn't scare people away. In fact, you heard in a number of those responses that reference to old line Republicans, you know, how Republicans used to be. Well, Larry exhibited that because of his pedigree, who his daddy was. His daddy was a conscientious old school Republican who was more libertarian in his view on social issues, which animates Larry's perspective on issues like choice, but at the same time was very, very much rule of law oriented, thus standing ground against Nixon and saying, you got to go. You violate the law, you got to go. And he was the first Republican, his daddy was, to call for that. So I think people sort of connect to a lot of that. And it made a difference, Sarah, in how they would come to view him over the initial 4 years. That was a real test for a Republican administration. And if you fail that test, and this was the problem that Ehrlich and I both ran into in 2006. The national brand was so bad for Republicans, the war in Iraq, big government Republicanism, that we not only were unable to hold together the coalition with our own base, but those Democrats who moved over into our space wanted to send a message to the national Republicans that they were sick and tired of the way we were governing nationally. So those of at the state level paid the price. Hogan created a separation between him and the national Republican brand. At the very beginning, was not a supporter of Trump in 16, made that very clear 2 years into his administration. So that separation helped him when it was re-election time in 2018. They couldn't stick the Trump brand on him the way the Bush brand was stuck on Larry and myself in 2006.
I just want to highlight something you said about Hogan's dad. One of the things that's so interesting to me is if you look at some of the most staunch, not just Trump critics, but people who've stood up to Trump actively and showed real courage, they're political legacies. Lisa Murkowski's a political legacy. Yes. Liz Cheney's a political legacy. Mitt Romney's a political legacy. And so is Larry Hogan. And I just find that, I don't know if it's because they've got a deeper level of public service in their blood, or if they watched a different generation of politicians do.
Look at the political legacy of those individuals you just named and how they responded. And look at the political legacy of Romney McDaniel, and how she responded.
She dropped the name so she could get out of there.
Exactly. So each responds differently, for sure. But there's a quality there that I think voters look for. It is an unspoken test of character and philosophical orientation that matters to them. And so when you have someone like Lisa Murkowski in Alaska or a Larry Hogan in Maryland who stand firm in that philosophy and that point of view and is consistent about it, voters are less afraid. They're less scared of you. They're less worried about your going off the reservation. Your trust factor with them strengthens. And I think that's a big part of what you see as a shortage among Republicans and the voters who do not support them is they don't trust them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
All right, let's talk about the Democratic frontrunner in this race, Congressman David Trone. So he's the CEO of the chain Total Wine & More, great chain, and he's plowed over $41 million of his own money into this campaign so far. I spent a lot of money at Total Wine, so I guess he's done all right there.
And that's just the primary.
He's leading the primary by 13 points in the latest 538 average. There was one internal poll by Angela Alsobrooks, who is his main Democratic primary opponent, that showed it was a 3-point race. Still, he was up in that. And I don't know about you. I know that you live in Maryland. I live in Maryland. I cannot show my kids a YouTube video without seeing a Dave Trone ad.
Right.
Like, he knows you're in Maryland and he is hitting you. And I'm like, I'm going to turn on Blippi for them. Like, they don't need to watch this ad on your education policy. I don't know. They're putting a lot of money into it. And it wasn't just me. Like, the people in the focus group, they had heard about him. Like, he had much higher name recognition, right, but still they like didn't know that much about him. Let's listen.
So he actually is my congressman. I don't know a ton about him, which I kind of like. Like, I don't love the people that are in the news all the time, just normally for bad reasons. I know he owns Total Wine. He's extremely rich. His ads are everywhere. I couldn't tell you a single piece of legislation that he's passed, to be honest, but most people seem to like him though.
But I haven't really dove too much on his views and what he's done, although I've seen a little bit of ads here and there.
The ads are always the same. There are a lot of endorsements, and just the sheer volume makes me mute when they're appearing. It's a sort of information overload.
Okay, I remember him always talking about prison reform and not locking up innocent people. And I do remember something about school as well. Yeah, that's what I remember from David Trone. And the other candidate I heard of, but it seems like David Trone's been like running by himself because his commercials seem like they've been on longer for some reason.
I like what I hear about him. He's been in the county for a long time and he does a lot of stuff with the rehab, and I know him, like the other guy said, for Total Wine. I think he's done things for the county for a long time.
Just from what I can remember, I do believe that he supports the women's right for abortion. That was one thing that kind of drew me in about him, that he, you know, he does support that.
So I feel like the few things that I have seen from him, he does support criminal justice reform, education funding as well, and involved with issues such as related to small businesses, growth, economic development, which is very important, I feel like, to work on, and a good quality in general for a candidate.
So what do you think, Michael? Do you think Trone is a good general election candidate? I will just say he doesn't strike me as the most inspiring guy, but he is throwing a lot of money around. So what do you think?
I think he'll make a very good general election candidate, and I think he'll be a formidable general election candidate. I know David. I've watched him from the moment he emerged politically in the state. You can tell from the focus groups, those who are from Montgomery County versus those who are not from Montgomery County. And that speaks to the value of spending $41 million in your primary and still having people outside of your district in the county still know at least enough, a serviceable amount about you, and that will aid him in a general. It's a little less work that he will have to do than my county executive, Angela Alsobrooks, will need to do, who is far less known statewide as having trouble. And Trone is actually right now running an ad exploiting the trouble she's having inside of her own county with voters. having elected officials in the county who have endorsed Trone do an ad for him. So there is a real interesting dynamic at play on the Democratic side. Before Hogan, this race was one in which the Democrats had to make a very difficult choice, one that Steny Hoyer was pushing, and he and I talked about this quite a bit, the fact that there are no female in the congressional delegation at all. So the Democrats had made the conscious decision that they wanted a female there. And, you know, going back to the governor's race in 2022, you know, there were a lot of entreaties to her to not run for governor in exchange for support to run for the U.S. Senate. And that explains the early lineup of a lot of endorsements behind also Brooke without really understanding and vetting how voters in Prince George's County felt about her.
That is so interesting and makes so much sense because there, I'm just going to play it. I mean, the other major Democrat in this race is Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. So she's been endorsed by Wes Moore, by Chris Van Hollen, and the majority of the state's congressional delegation. And she's running that ad being like, I've got all the big endorsements. But man, the people in the group were not fans. Let's listen.
Then she became a county executive in PG County. And PG County isn't governed too well. So I'm thinking that maybe it's too early for Ms. Alsobrooks to move up. Maybe it's time for her to stay in her current position and learn how to govern a little more.
She needs to stay where she is. I lived in Prince George's County. And I moved because of some of the policies that were not taken seriously. I mean, they're small things to some, but big things to me. For example, we used to have two trash days. She took away one. I don't know why. Trash piles up, rats, rodents. But she needs to stay where she is and learn her role and stay out of the pockets of investors and people that are building all these homes and restaurants that we don't need. And I mean, food deserts. It's a lot that she ran on, but she didn't uphold it. So I don't trust her.
From what I've read on some issues, she's too far left for me. And then I agree, she doesn't really have any experience. She needs to find her place where she is before she can move in.
I feel like we haven't had a really good showing when it comes to female leaders in Baltimore between Stephanie Rawlins-Blake, Sheila Dixon. I just felt like it was probably paid for something or something was promised in order for her to get all those endorsements. Like, I just don't feel like it was earned properly.
I like her for the county, doing stuff in the county. But I think Trone would be a better choice to go into the Senate. I've been kind of watching what's going on, and I think he would be a better choice than her. The endorsements they can get, but just like Wes Moore, I didn't vote for him either. So, you know, just because you get all the top people backing you don't mean you're going to do a good job.
Okay, so I'm just going to caveat this with one point, which is that all these people voted for Larry Hogan and Biden. So, like, they are on the more moderate spectrum, which is not also Brooke's base. But I still thought these were enormously telling about how much people knew about the job she was doing in PG County and how unhappy they were with that. I mean, you got to pick up the trash, right? You know, thank you.
No one could understand why that policy was implemented and the fact that the promise was made to restore twice a week trash pickup not being met matters. And look, being a county executive is no different than being a mayor. And, you know, people expect the same thing from you that they would expect from the mayor of Baltimore. When trash collection is not done right, it's a visible sign of that failure in my neighborhood. I'm holding you accountable. Yeah, the council may have voted to suspend it, but you're the county executive. And so it's those things that have come back to bite her in a way. And I hear it in the Giant where I shop. I hear it in other parts of Prince George's County that she needs to stay and finish the job. And they're not willing to reward her with higher office because they feel that she's not done the job that she signed up for two terms to do. If you can't get it done in two terms, why should you be elevated to the U.S. Senate on a statewide level where you're not going to get anything done there? And that's the connection that a lot of people make. When you heard that in some of those responses, I think Trump will do a better job, you know, as a U.S. senator than she has as a county executive. And that's tough.
This is an interesting thing to me about voters. So I think that there is a type of B-minus analysis that would say, well, you know, you've got this more progressive Black woman. She will appeal more to Black voters and sort of white progressives. And it's interesting to me that in this these groups, both the groups had more Black people than white people in them. So, like, I think the analysis would go, like, they don't want some white billionaire, right? But, like, when you listen to voters, what voters want oftentimes is just results, especially at the local level. And so, like, does it surprise you, I guess? Like, you just hear a lot of Black women in these groups saying, she's not doing a good job and I won't vote for her. Does it surprise you?
Nope, doesn't at all. It doesn't for a whole host of reasons. Some of it is not very tasteful. There is still, at every level, hesitancy to give women power. And I think a lot of folks inside and outside of politics don't like to acknowledge that or have that very uncomfortable conversation. Voters would never ascribe themselves as anything but progressive in that frame of mind, that thinking, but they're not. They're not. Because if they were, Hillary Clinton would have been elected president twice. So they're just not. You know, Black voters are no different than any other group of voters in that regard. I think the other aspect of it is, yeah, we don't have hang-ups about white billionaires like white voters do, as long as they're getting stuff done. If you're getting stuff done, okay, I'm gonna evaluate that in the context of everything else that I'm evaluating. And if you come out ahead of an African-American female county executive, guess what? Who am I voting for? The person I think is going to get something done. So there are a number of forces that many in the Democratic Party still don't know how to control for in their own backyard. And the assumption that, oh, if we get the Democratic leadership to line up behind also Brooke, then everybody's going to fall in line. And no, they're not. And they're not because you're talking to a voting electorate among Democrats, 70% of whom supported and still like Larry Hogan, number one. Number two, you need to understand that and then extrapolate that into your conversation in the Democratic primary. That means the more center right of the two candidates is likely going to have an advantage that you're not accounting for. And that's being borne out right now in this primary space among Democratic voters who like Trone over also Brooks. Even among some of the more progressive leaning voters, she falls short for them because she failed on trash collection. She failed on economic development issues. So there's some double-edged swords there that are at play that are working against also Brooke that, to his credit, Trone saw ahead of laying out his campaign for this nomination. And this gets to the second point that I want to finish on is when the race was just either one of them up against some no-name MAGA Republican, like we saw with Dan Cox in the gubernatorial race, then the battle was, okay, where do I land on Trone versus also Brooke? And guess what? In that environment, the conversation gives a little bit more of advantage to also Brooks, make it a little bit more competitive. You throw in Larry Hogan, now becomes a different calculation for Democrats. It's like, okay, who of these two in a general election can beat Larry Hogan? That's advantage Trone all day long. I don't care how you cut it. Why? Because the brother can stroke himself a check.
Yeah.
He can go one for one, toe to toe with Larry on the money. She can't. Number two, you're now talking about a center left, quasi center right Democrat up against a center right Republican. With the Senate on the line, it then becomes a very, very different calculation for those voters.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'll just say when it comes to voters, I take your point on some of the internalized misogyny. I know that's real. I just have listened to so many voters where I've asked women voters about women candidates, Black voters about Black candidates. And, you know, nobody wants to vote that way. Women will tell you, I am not going to vote for somebody just because she's a woman.
Right.
And you just hear it across every demographic where I think there's this like assumption that if you can find somebody in a certain demographic, they will appeal to that demographic. And I just do not find that to be true, generally.
you also have to take into account that there is a level of misogyny and racism comfort that's given when you say that. Because now when I say, well, I'm just not going to vote for the woman because she's a woman. I'm not going to vote for the black because they're black. That's a comfort spot. You then need to press the issue. When I ran for the U.S. Senate, I think you and I talked about this. I wanted to press that issue because I did not trust what voters would say about my race if asked a straight up frontline question.
Meaning that you thought that they would say they didn't care that you were black, but that they did.
But they did. And I found the proof in the polling when I asked two questions back to back. And the first was, would you vote for an African-American for the United States Senate? And the second was, would your neighbor vote for an African-American for the U.S. Senate? The first came back 78% yes. The second came back 48% yes. So I knew you're living in that neighborhood with a whole lot of people who won't vote for me. I've now got to take that into consideration and look a little more strategically and carefully about how I'm going to attract voters and get them to actually pull the lever for me.
Yeah, I guess I don't want to take us too far afield, but this is an interesting point. It's a good example of voters will do this thing, like, let's just take Mayor Pete, because this one that happened recently, where people will be like, oh, I really like Mayor Pete, but I just don't think America is going to vote for a gay president. Yeah. Or I really liked Hillary Clinton, but I don't think people are going to vote for a female president. And I'm always sort of like, is that true? Like, is the problem that you perceive everybody to be like a little more racist than you are, a little more sexist, a little more homophobic, whatever. And that's just because we have a low opinion of our neighbors. I don't know.
I think it plays out in this race. I mean, I think it's a factor in this race. And it's not that they won't elevate a woman to the U.S. Senate. We had Barbara Mikulski, for example, in the Senate. Question is, are you willing to elevate a black woman to the U.S. Senate? That's a legitimate question. You know, how do you really feel about a billionaire businessman? Progressives would tell you we hate them, but the rank and file Democrats are like, no, we don't. So there are these spaces that are oftentimes predetermined what people are going to think, when in fact that may or may not be how they really feel, which is what I love about the work you do, is that you try to peel that back a little bit and sort of get beyond sort of the face forward, yes or no, up or down, and really get people to answer the second, third, and fourth questions about that candidate, which may give you a better insight of what the electorate really think about them. And I think that's why your focus groups show that Trone is stronger in the Democratic primary and possibly, and we'll talk about it, in a general election, we'll make this a much more competitive race.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
All right. So as you were just saying, we should talk about the general election. But I do wonder, because with the focus groups, I am always trying to peel back the layers and really understand what it is people are saying. And I guess I wonder if Angela Alsobrooks was a more moderate Black woman who had done a good job of picking up the trash. Might she be performing better?
Yes.
It's hard to suss out from these groups, because to me, they seem to have specific problems with her that I heard that they could name. It wasn't this like, I just don't think that this person could stand up to like world leaders or like, I don't know, right. like they have some vaguely sexist thing that they say versus she did not pick up the trash or she is in the pockets of the developers. I don't know if that's true or not, but like they had pretty specific grievances with her.
Yeah, they do. And again, a county executive is like a mayor.
Yeah.
And so you're going to have very specific things that you expect and look for from their public service. And when they fall short on that, that's what sticks in your craw. And you're more readily prepared to recount and push back out than anything else. So, yeah, it does cut both ways for her and someone in her position. I think to your question, if she had picked up the trash and she was not perceived to be in the pocket of certain interests in the county, et cetera, and all those other negatives that they ascribe to her, the question then would become, how would she be faring in this primary? I think a damn sight better than she is. I think the things that she stumbled on, like raising money and political organization, would be less of a problem for her for the reasons that there would be more interest in people coming to her campaign and wanting to be a part of her campaign. And there'd certainly be more interest from the donor class to give to her campaign. Then you're now contrasting someone who was a hard worker who's delivered results against the voices that you heard in the Trone segment who said, well, I don't really know what he's done or what bills he's passed. She could then pivot and show that contrast.
Right.
And she can't because she's got her own weak spot in terms of what she hasn't done for voters. So,
yeah. Okay. Now, as much as these voters liked Larry Hogan and they liked his time as governor, they were split on whether they could trust him in the Senate. And this is going to be what he contends with for the rest of his campaign, whether he can convince these left-leaning voters, like we're hearing in this group, that he'll consistently stand up to the worst impulses of the GOP. Let's listen.
I don't think that he will try to get reelected. So he's not afraid of Trump's buddies financing a primary challenger to him. And in general, he already proved himself to be a good governor. No challenger can really stand up to that.
Well, when we were going through the whole COVID fiasco, and I don't feel that he's easily persuaded by the folks at the big house. And a lot of times you need somebody that will push back and take a stand. So I like that about him.
You know, I want to vote for Democrat, but I also am looking at the history of the individual and how they've come through on, I mean, not on everything, because no one's perfect. We're not all going to agree on the same thing and how it should be done. But what I've seen of him, I've been pretty impressed. So I kind of want to give him another shot, you know, at this position. So I'm still torn.
Hogan was a strong leader in Maryland for two terms as governor. And the way I see it, I'm going to vote for the best person for the job of senator. And if Hogan happens to be that person, which right now I think he is, then that's who I'm going to go with.
So he was just doing remarkably well. In the first group we did, everybody but one person was going to vote for him head-to-head against both the Democrats. I was genuinely surprised. But I guess, look, the polls have Hogan leading both Trone and also Brooks in head-to-head by like double digits. And I think we just heard people tell you why, right? He's a well-known and well-liked quantity in Maryland, and his opponents, they are not yet. But he is about to have many millions in advertising, probably from David Trone, poured into reminding voters that he'd be part of a Republican majority, no matter how much they like his personal vibe. And we heard from some former Hogan voters who were skeptical of voting for him for Senate and the National Democratic Forces. They're going to spend the next several months creating more of this sentiment. Let's listen.
This may be a little simple-minded, but I'm not doing anything to help the MAGA machine. So to put another Republican in office, I'm just not going to vote for that. I think he did some things to just kind of help his buddies out. Like, I think the whole moving to school after Labor Day was just to help his Ocean City buddies out and their businesses and whatnot. There's also I don't know the exact details, but there was like a road he built that somehow benefited him. So I think he does look out for himself and his friends in some cases.
I think we need another Democrat in the Senate. I'm going to be real honest. That's my thing. After I've seen what the Republicans have done in the House and the Senate, I don't think he'll be able to change some of their minds. So I think we need to keep that seat.
So I agree with his political courage. And I think that I'm more interested in having more diversity within the Senate. There's never been a Black woman in the Senate.
Yeah, he's not going to be influenced, but mind you, he still need the money to be able to run for Senate. And trust you me, he can be swayed. In order for him to get there, there's always going to be some lobbyist, whether it's the NRA, whether it's all these other groups that will sway him to be able to go and get that Senate seat. And once he's there, all it takes is one click, yay or nay, and he will go ahead and vote with the rest of them. I'm not a big fan of what's going on with the Republican Party at this time.
He could change the majority in the Senate, and that would be big.
All right. So we heard a lot. We heard from the people who like Hogan, would vote for Hogan because they know Hogan. Then we hear from the people who, even if they kind of like Hogan, they do not want a Republican in the Senate. And this gets to, Michael, my central question that I want to know from you, because I struggle with this, genuinely. I love Larry Hogan, and I think he is a great guy, and I think he was a great governor, and I think he'd be a good senator, maybe a great senator. But I have been let down so many times by Republicans. And look, Mitt Romney has been just the best. He's been the best. But he's still like, there's something about the need to have someone eat lunch with you in the Senate, like whatever room, and like the pressure that you feel. And I'm sure he'd do have like a little caucus with Murkowski and Collins, right, and, right. You know, but like, which should it be? Should we not want Trump to have more power, or do we want Republicans in the Senate who will stand up to Trump?
That's a good question. Okay,
what do you want? What do you yourself want? Kind of a personal question, but like, is Hogan? Are you like?
Oh, I'm supporting Larry Hogan 100%. No,
oh, okay, great.
I'm not worried about Larry Hogan as a United States Senator in terms of his alignment with the GOP. He will be, I think, the Susan Collins, Murkowski wing will grow by one. I think he will show, to be honest, a little bit more independence than Collins has, for example, where if he tells you he's not voting a certain way, he's not voting that way. Or if he feels something is fundamentally wrong, he's not going to then backtrack on that. I mean, I've known Larry for 35 years, and I have not seen anything in him from his work in business, and certainly during our administration when he was our appointment secretary and as governor, that is inconsistent with that particular attribute of his character in terms of staying true to that. But I do appreciate your concern and the concerns of those in the focus group about what this may mean politically. I think part of what will be important for Larry to do is he will run as an independent Republican. He'll run in the Republican primary as he is, and he'll be under the Republican banner on the ballot. But I think he will have enough things that he can point to in his service as governor and what he will tell you he's going to do as a U.S. senator that will show you where he will stand. I know he's already getting questions about, will you vote for the Republican majority leader? He's got to answer that question. He's got to have a way in which doesn't scare off those Democratic voters who are concerned about a Republican majority. He will just be one of 100. And if Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley are controlling the Republican caucus and are in the main power flow, that's going to be a consideration that voters will have to make. And I can appreciate that. I think it's going to be a very clear line of delineation between the Democratic nominee, regardless of if it's Trone or also Brooks, about what that means for voters. So yeah, that's going to be the Achilles heel, I think, in many respects for the campaign. And these voters that we just heard kind of reflect that. And I think there may be more of them who really like Larry as governor, loved him as governor, but may have concerns about a Senator Hogan and what that may mean given the balance of power, especially if Donald Trump is president, and what that potentially could mean for the country. So it's going to be a delicate balancing act. This issue for him is what abortion may be for other candidates running as a Republican around the country.
Because he has been a pretty outspoken Trump critic, so it's sort of hard to paint him as like just another Republican vote. And right. I do wonder, do you think Larry Hogan has to run as an anti-Trump Republican in the general?
No, I don't think he needs to, because we all know, I mean, not in Maryland. I mean, maybe in some other states.
But he'll get asked about Trump all the time, won't he? I mean,
yeah, he'll get asked questions about Trump at the top of the ticket. Actually, it'll be interesting because it'll be the first time that Larry and Trump were on the same ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that that was something that his team strategically will have to work through and be prepared to address, because the top of your ticket is someone that you are fundamentally at odds with. And what does that mean? And since there's a lot of pressure on down ballot races, including the U.S. Senate, and getting turnout for that, if he's pressing too much one way against Trump, does that create a chill on the Republican side and the center right independent voter who then would be able to vote in a general election, although they don't get that privilege in the Republican primary? Does that cause a chilling effect on them? And they decide either to stay home or to vote for Trump, but not vote for him for the U.S. Senate. So, yeah, these are going to be some of the political calculations in the messaging that his team is going to have to address immediately after this primary. And actually, Sarah, you're already starting to see some of that in the commercials that Larry is running, where he really is running against the institution not functioning and not working and wanting to be someone who is there to pull the right and the left back into the workspace, right? Where we get some things done. His most recent ad that just came out this past week focuses a little bit more on that. So I think you're already beginning to see his team sort of anticipate the questions you're asking and the points that were raised by your focus group about what a Republican Senator Larry Hogan means to, number one, control of the Senate, and two, from a Republican standpoint, a president-elect Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, look, I want there to be 100 Larry Hogans in the Senate.
Yeah.
And it's a tough time to force me to want it like right this second, just because I'm like, don't give these guys more seats. At the same time, I do have a lot of faith in Larry Hogan, like in his like fundamental decency.
Yeah.
And I think we're just not in a political environment anymore where you see many sort of a state that's dominated by one party electing a member of the other party to national office. And it's a healthy sign of democracy when we can do that, right? Because it's means we're not so toxically polarized that we can't sort of rise above partisanship to vote for the person. And a lot of these voters talked about that, the wanting to vote for a person. And I think we should encourage that in our politics. I think that Larry Hogan, like feeling like he's in a state where it is more Democratic, gives him more latitude, I think, in the Senate to push back hard. I think it's a miracle he doesn't have a MAGA Republican primary challenger that's super well funded. Like, this is one of those sort of Mitch McConnell moves where they manage to, because I don't think he could win a hard fought Republican primary with like a big grassroots person.
He would not.
But they cleared the field for him.
But yeah, that is an accurate assessment there. It would be very hard for him, despite his popularity. It would be difficult to translate in an environment running against a well-funded and popular MAGA opponent, meaning someone who's, you know, blessed by Donald Trump himself with Trump at the top of the ticket. We've seen too many races around the country where that's just not a good scenario for a center-right mainstream Republican in this environment. But he doesn't have that. So he has the ability of saying to the base, so what you going to do? You know, you want the seat? I'm the only Republican who can take the seat. So what you going to do? So they'll hold their nose and do that. But he still has to be mindful that in a general election, if you twist the wrong way or twerk too much against Trump, you still need to have a certain percentage of that Republican base votes in certain counties to win. And so he's got to be mindful of that, because the interesting thing about a Republican winning statewide is it's not all Democrats and it's not all Republicans. It is how you really do create that coalition, not just on the right and the left, but between and among counties. Prince George's in a Montgomery County offset with the Baltimore City. You've got the central portions of Howard County, Anne Arundel County, for example. How does that translate with the growth and the rise of the political strength in the western parts of the state as well? And then, of course, there's the ever-present and always fun Eastern Shore, which is God's country of conservatism for sure, but it's God's country, period. You've got to appreciate the strength and the beauty of a Maryland politically that is in so many respects, and I know you appreciate what I'm about to say, is a microcosm of the country in so many ways. And that's reflected, going back to how we started the conversation, much more among the rank and file voters out there than it is the people who actually hold titles of representative and Senate, the state Senate, and county executive and county council. The elected leadership tends to be, which is really weird when you stop and think about it, you know, tend to be a slightly more out of step with the voters who elect them, but somehow it works. I don't know.
Somehow it works. You know what else works, Michael Steele? You being on this podcast.
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for doing this. And thanks to all of you for listening to the Focus Group podcast. We will be back next week. So remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to The Bulwark on YouTube. We will see you soon. Bye-bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.